The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hi, I'm Bunny Guinness, and this is my podcast, Bunny in the Garden, with someone special. Someone who is well known for something other than their green fingers, but who is also a mustard-keen gardener. I'll discover them through their garden, why, how, and when they garden, the best tips they've learnt, and their gardening style and approach. It is a real joy to be in the fabulous garden of Bella Hoare. Bella is best known as a banker and artist. I'm not sure which first. She's a member of the renowned Hoare banking family. Henry the Magnificent, as he was known, started the world-famous gardens at Stourhead. He was Bella's distant relation. Bella lives nearby, and her garden at Gasper Cottage on the Stourhead estate is open to the public and is shared on her YouTube channel. Bella, it is fab to be here. You're a passionate gardener, a fellow of the RHS, and gardening must be in your blood. And at what point did this passion manifest itself?
Well, the passion for being outside and being in nature was there all the way through my childhood. I grew up running around the woods you see all around us. Flowers, however, a bit of a closed book. Mum was into flowers and I never really was. It wasn't until I came here to Gasper Cottage that I actually had a garden to work with. And my entry-level drug was dahlias. A sister-in-law got me into dahlias, and that was a slippery slope. And I've enjoyed the ride all the way up, or down, whichever way you look at it.
Ah, right. So you were born in 68 in London, but you were raised here. Is your father and your mother, are they real gardeners too? I mean, coming from the Hoare family with this amazing garden on your doorstep, it must have been indoctrinated into you.
Well, Stourhead's as much about trees as it is about garden, and Dad's definitely into trees. Mum's always been a gardener. She's had various beautiful gardens, and she lives in Jersey now, and they've got a small but beautiful garden. Even now, she loves to get out there and do the deadheading herself. She says no one else does it quite properly.
I always remember the story of Rosemary Feary throwing her secateurs at some poor young gardener because he was deadheading delphiniums. And instead of just taking off the individual florets, he took off the whole stem. And she sent her secateurs flying at him. People get very, very bound up about how to deadhead correctly. It's not just chopping off the heads, as you might think.
No, there's science. And then there's art, and then there's your own personal preferences.
Yeah, and it's a heady mixture, and getting it how you want it is very particular, I'm sure. But you went to various schools, then the City of London Polytechnic to do a BA in economics. Now, obviously, because you had banking in your blood, did you just feel that it was natural to go into the world of finance?
Not really. I was quite determined I wasn't going to end up at Hoare's Bank. But I did go and work at Cazenove's as a graduate trainee, which was fantastic. And, you know, I think my dad probably did get me the interview, but I reckon anyone can get an interview, but you've then got to get the job yourself. At least that's what I like to tell myself. And so that was a really great training, and it was a lovely place to have as a first job. But then I took a kind of left turn, literally, and went off to Moscow with my first husband.
But so before we go into Moscow, so you never thought art, horticulture professionally, that would not have been even a flicker of a dream?
No. I would have no idea. I mean, art was something that you did on holiday, something you did for fun. The thought of that as a career, I mean, I think my parents would have had an epi.
But Henry the Magnificent, you see, I do wonder he was obviously a keen horticulturist, but would he have ever actually gardened when he was doing Stourhead? Or would he have said, my man, just go and dig that lake and plant those trees?
I mean, I think at the scale he was operating at, he very much operated through other people. And don't forget, while doing all that garden, he was still running Hawes Bank as well.
Yeah, and he was a top banker.
He was a top
really
banker.
Good. Yes.
And, you know, the classic thing is in the third generation, you lose the family business. And he was a brilliant banker. He really got the bank onto a solid footing for the next kind of 100 years after him.
Yeah. No, it is very unusual, isn't it, for a family business to last more than three generations.
Yeah.
Rothschild's exceptions, Hawes' exceptions, a few exceptions.
Yeah.
And you can see why, can't you, why it happens like that. You're just not motivated the same when you've got... you know, a bit of money behind you, perhaps. But so you moved to Moscow. Now, that fascinates me because you learnt Russian. You spent 6 months learning it.
Yep, 6 months.
And you can write it? Write it and let
me... I could then. I never really got to grips with handwriting, but I could type in Russian and I could read typewritten Russian. Handwritten Russian, all the letters are completely different formations.
Yeah.
And actually, even quite a lot of Russians can't read Russian handwriting, rather amazingly.
Really? Yeah. And so you went and worked there for Brunswick Warburg as a stockbroker, were you?
Yeah, so I was in the back office. So someone else was deciding what to buy and sell, and I was making sure that they actually bought it and actually sold it.
Oh, right. And living in Russia, now that absolutely fascinates me. I've never been there. The gardens, the Russian gardens...
So
I always imagine a lot are in flats and a few have their dachas and things like that. But
yeah, dacha covers a kind of world of opportunity from, you know, Pasternak's house, which is a beautiful five-bedroom house in a kind of nearly an acre of land, through to what, you know, would be described as a kind of a half or a quarter plot, which is really allotments.
Yes.
And when I moved to Russia, it was in the mid-90s. At that point, 40% of the calories consumed in Moscow were homegrown.
40%?
Yeah.
But those winters...
Everybody had an allotment and properly grew food and properly preserved it and kept it and lived off it. Because you couldn't buy fresh food.
That is phenomenal. So even in those winters, and they will be under snow for how many months?
Five.
So that's all the carrots and things would be in storage, potatoes.
Yep.
But their diet must be pretty carrot potato based.
Well, don't forget the beetroot.
Oh, beetroot.
Not my favourite vegetable.
Oh,
but,
I love
you know.
It. Oh, what? Well, I'm impressed.
Yeah.
I'm really impressed. And so they garden, so they must have a big tie to the land if they're producing a lot of their diet like that. But it would be still a bit of a luxury to have an allotment. I mean, there must be, I imagine, hundreds of people in little rooms and things with no access.
I mean, you know, I lived in a perfectly ordinary Russian block of flats and everybody had somewhere to go and grow vegetables. And, you know, it might be shared amongst a family. So you quite often got the grandparents who go and basically camp on the allotment for the whole summer and tend all the vegetables. And you just go out at weekends and help.
What a fantastic system.
I mean, I imagine that's all broken down now, but that's what it was like even in the 90s.
Why do you think it's broken down now? Because there's better access.
I think they're much richer. I think you've now got a middle class who quite like fancy the idea of going to a restaurant.
Right.
I mean, there weren't any restaurants in the 90s.
Gosh, that is interesting. And you think their standard of living now, how would you compare it to ours?
I mean,
the average Brit.
You know, I haven't been there for 20 years, so I'm woefully out of date. And, you know, in Moscow, I think you have got a proper middle class. They've got a flat, they've got a car, they've got appliances, they probably go on holiday.
Mm.
In the regions, I imagine it gets tougher.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't had a lot of contact with Russians, but I did, when I was working in Japan, I had a Russian interpreter who married a Japanese. And she said one of the things that really struck her was in Russia, if you smile, they think you're stupid. Whereas in Japan, all women smile at the men in a very charming way. And it's a sort of slightly subservient greeting. And that seems to be amazing. That's why we all think Russians are a bit grim, isn't it? Because smiling is it really still, when you were there, a sign of stupidity almost?
I don't know that I've ever noticed that, but they are incredibly direct. I do remember, you know, because I was working, we had nannies. I remember the nanny saying to Tom, who was... two.
And your son.
My son. He'd snatched a biscuit and she was correcting him in Russian, saying, no, be polite. Say give.
Now. Stamp.
And, you know, And managing people in an office environment, you know, if you want to get something done in England, you have to come and ask nicely and say, I know how busy you are and how to do all that. If you think do that in Russian, they just think you don't mean it.
Right. So you have to be very direct, very firm.
Funny, I need this report by Tuesday. And then you walk away. Hmm. No, please, no, thank you, no, excuse me. Just a direct instruction.
In some ways, I think that's quite economical and quite efficient. But do you find it? How did you find that? You just got into the groove and you did it.
You just get used to it.
And then when you came back, did we all think you were rude and demanding?
It was a bit of an adjustment.
Yes, I bet. So that is fascinating. And then the public gardens. There are grand public gardens with huge statues and things in Russia, presumably, or not?
Yes, they tend to be pretty formal. Mm. And, you know, there's a lot of summer bedding. Because, you know, most things don't make it through the winters.
Yeah. So it's quite intensive work. Yeah, lovely. So you mentioned your son, Tom, and he's almost, he is just 27, isn't he? So he's
27 this weekend.
Oh, lovely. And he'll be a quarter Russian.
Yes, so he is a quarter Russian. His first language was Russian, but we came back when he was nearly three and he switched in 6 weeks.
He went from
monoglot Russian to monoglot English and we completely failed to make him bilingual.
Really? And that was because you spoke to him in Moscow in Russian?
Yep. And he was at the Russian Detsky Sad kindergarten.
Yeah.
And he had a Russian nanny. And then he came back and we thought we'd better get him ready to head off to nursery.
Yeah.
So we spoke to him in English and then he wouldn't speak any Russian and we kind of just let it go. It wasn't a fight we could cope with.
No. God, that's interesting. And so then there was the crash, and so you were made redundant from Brunswick, and you came back to the UK in 2000 and started working for Horse.
Yes.
So that must have been amazing. But going into a family business as a whore, as a proper whore, not a whore... So many people must make that joke.
There is
no joke
you can produce that I haven't heard before.
Yes, I'm sure. But for our American listeners,
yes,
she is an H-O, Bella is an H-O-A-R-E, not a W-H-O-R-E.
And one is terribly respectable and quite an old profession, but not as old as the other one.
Yes. Very nicely put indeed. And so did you find that difficult? Did you think because of your name...
I mean, when I first came back, I went and did some consultancy in the bank because my cousins, you know, had been sort of headhunting me in. And I was pretty unsure whether I wanted to go and work for my family business. You know, could I cope with working with my father? There's lots of other dynamics you have to think about. Mm. And so I did some consultancy. And after about 6 weeks, I was like, right, where do I sign? Please throw away the keys. I'm staying.
Yeah.
And it was a fantastic decision. It's a huge privilege to be part of a long tradition and to feel that you're doing your bit to make it better for the future.
Mm. And do you think Tom will go into it likewise or not? Or too early to say?
I mean, he's certainly showing no signs of it. He's a game designer. So quick plug for Antler Studios.
Oh.
He'll be launching their first game, I think, later this year.
Oh, so he'll probably be making far more money than even bankers.
Well, let's hope so. Let's hope so.
But it was all going swimmingly, and then there was this dreadful tragedy which really changed your life.
Yes. Yeah, so 2008, in the March, I was at work and I got a call, and the message was that, you know, Boris and Tom had been in a car crash. Boris was dead. Tom was badly injured. How are you going to get to Salisbury? And so you're left kind of not knowing which way is up, how you can breathe, how you can do anything. Mm. And you sort of stammer, I think I'll get the train. So they said, all right, we'll send a car. So 10 minutes later, I'm in a police car going 6 miles an hour down the wrong side of the Strand.
God.
So get to Salisbury Hospital. Tom was in surgery. You know, it was horrific. And, you know, he then got moved down to Southampton. And we had 6 weeks, sort of really intensive time with him in hospital. Then he came home. And I was nursing for about another 6 months. He was very, very badly injured.
Mm.
But he has made an amazing recovery. And if you met him now, you wouldn't think, oh dear, what happened there? You know,
wow.
You know, he's great.
I just cannot believe how that would affect you. But in a way, it does make you value things more, doesn't it? When something life-threatening happens to someone so close, it makes you take a real rein check on your life and what you want to do. it at that point then, because you were home, all that the garden and the art kicked in, or was that later?
So the garden was already quite a big thing by then. You know, I mean, we've sort of had a look in the garden in the willow trellis and stuff that you were admiring. I did that in 2005.
So the garden, you moved in here in 2000.
2000.
And so that happened when you were 8 years. You were starting to get your roots down here. Yeah. And this wonderful garden that we're standing in now, I mean, we could not believe the views as we came down the drive. It really was stunning. And it has got the cottage, the front cottage look of the house. And then it is a bit like The Lion and the Witch and the Wardrobe, isn't it? You come around the back and all these different spaces are revealed. And they have, each space has its own identity. Very definite, very different from the other. But they dwell really well together. And this bit, which comes off the kitchen, I imagine, is the bit you have your breakfast in and you pop out when you're doing a phone call.
So this is, it's interesting. So this is west facing. So in high summer, it's a lovely place to have breakfast because you're in the shade.
Yeah.
And it's really cool.
Yeah.
And then in sort of the ends of the year, it's a really nice place to sit in the evening because you're in the sun. But I'm not actually very good at sitting in the sun in any kind of heat.
Mm. Those Russian years.
I know. And also, I've just got that kind of unbelievably white English skin. Now I can get sunburned from a photo. So we're generally kind of hogging the shade as we go around the house, around the garden, rather than chasing the sun.
Yeah. And we've got a lovely terrace outside, immediately outside the door, and then you've got a beautifully striped lawn surrounded by beds, and there's a lovely old high brick wall with a lime wash sort of peeling off it. So it's got that lovely sort of patina on it. But the willow trellis that you've just mentioned is fascinating because it's here to my left, and you put this in, how many years ago did you say?
So that went in 2005, so 19 years ago.
And it's interesting because it is starting to self-graft, hasn't it? So bits are really well grafted in each other. So it's a structural trellis and it's got tufts of lively young willow coming off it, and it's also got moss. But behind it, you put in a yew hedge to help the shelter as the wind races around the corner, I bet, some days.
So depending on which way the wind is going, from either direction, it can be brutal. It's amazingly still here today, which is very lucky if we're trying to use a microphone.
Oh, it's wonderful. But I also love the way you put this willow trellis around your oil tank, because I don't think I've seen a better concealment of an oil tank in my life. And we often put those, you know, woven willow panels up and things. But to actually have a trellis... So you've just stuck wands of willow in the ground. You would have taken cuttings in the spring, pushed them in up 6 inches or so, made a lovely diamond trellis, as you would buy one from B&Q, but nicer. And then it roots within a few months, doesn't it? I remember we did a trellis seat like that for Chelsea 1 year, and we did it in a big plywood box. And we moved it in for Chelsea, and it was all rooted in. Within, I think we struck it in February, and it was a lovely growing structure by the May. So I think I've got a problem with a oil tank on a job, and I think I'm going to suggest they do that. It's superb. So should we move on round? Oh, I see you've got one on the other side. So you've got wings on both sides of this lovely willow trellis.
Yeah. And then in places it's got a bit patchy and bits have died back. So we're trying to put a few new bits in and train it up. But it's very hard to train it once it's there, because you put it in by weaving them down.
Yes.
If that makes sense.
Yes.
But I also quite like that it's got the honeysuckle growing over it, and at the end it's got some ivy growing over it, and it's all starting to look like it's been there forever.
Yes, because it has got sprouts in odd places, but in the main the trellis is bare and we've got this beautiful little tuft at the top. So I think it looks quite splendid.
If you come back in when we're open in September, those little tufts at the top are all 8 feet long.
You have to prune them about six times a year if you don't want them.
No, so
we leave them
to grow.
Oh, right.
And then Jack cuts them off in March.
Oh, right. Because some people just sort of prune them on and on relentlessly, don't they?
No.
And then you've got a big pergola there, which is your east facing, obviously, on the opposite side of this little wall garden. And on one end of the pergola is a beautiful thatched loo.
Yes, that was the privy of the house. I'd say it's now just a bit of storage, but we still refer to it as the privy.
And the pergola next door. So it's interesting. So you've got the big timber beams on the brick piers And then you've got umbrellas inside it. You yes. didn't decide to put a hood, a hat on it at all.
No. So, well, the aim is that the vines, which is the Vitis cognitia, the non-fruiting vine.
Dinner plate.
Will cover it over.
Yes.
But it hasn't yet. Yeah. So that I'm viewing the umbrellas as a temporary feature.
Ah, yeah, yeah. They are good, though. And what I haven't seen before is... And you're obviously a plants woman here because I can tell everything is tended beautifully. There's a very cottagey garden feel. We've got forget-me-nots, catmints, euphorbia, irises, salvias, all lovely, isn't it? All hugger-mugger, all the borders very full. But then we've got two privet, and they're ordinary privet.
Yep, standard.
Ligustrum avalifolium, yep. whatever it is. And yep. then tell me about them.
So this whole border, it's slightly hard to tell at this season, but it's designed as a hot border. So everything are sort of shades of reds and oranges.
Yes.
And we put in a lot of tender things that go in later in the year. And, you know, in high summer, it's an absolute mass of colour. But at the moment, it's not. And I decided a few years ago that it didn't have enough winter structure. So I thought it'd be a good idea to have two pillars that were green. So I thought, well, I'll put in privet because I know that grows well.
Yes.
I didn't realise quite how well it grows. And I have to say, my gardener, Jack, who is an absolute saint, hates it because to make it look good, you are cutting it about every 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Because you turn your back and it's grown before you put the tools away. And I had it shaped as two huge barrels. And I decided actually it was too blocky and they kind of got bigger than we wanted. So we've cut them back. And the idea is that they're going to echo the shape of the privy roof.
The pyramid.
So that yeah. so Jack's been out cutting pyramids. So at the moment, bizarrely, they're actually the same colour as the thatch because they're completely bare.
Yeah.
But hopefully by midsummer, they will go green.
Interesting idea.
And then have the stems bare at the bottom because that gives me more ground to plant things in.
Yeah. So that must have been quite a job, stripping all off the foliage off the bottom, was it, or not? Or did it just go bald from shade?
I mean, I think there was quite a lot of bald down there anyway, so I think he had to take a certain amount out, but yeah.
So we're looking at a border now which has got much cooler colours. We've got the catmint in flower. Is that the ordinary Six Hills or is
it? No, so that's Walker's Low.
Oh, Walker's Low, right. And behind it, beautiful pale pink lupins. Now, we always get questions on lupins in gardeners, on gardeners question time, because people find it difficult to grow them on and on and on. Do you replace yours regularly or what's your secret?
This will be their third year.
Right.
And we haven't replaced them yet.
Right.
Maybe if you ask me when they're 5 years old, I'll tell you if they need to be replaced.
But your soil would be acid here.
It's acid.
And I think
that helps, doesn't it? Draining. So I'm on the green sand here,
yeah.
which is sort of famous yeah. for rhododendrons, of which I've got three, I think. So not very many.
Because you don't like rhododendrons.
Well, they just take up an awful lot of space. Mm. And I tend to want more things rather than bigger things.
I'm no rhododendron fan. I wondered if there are lots next door at Stourhead. And so you thought, if I want to go and see my rhododendron.
They're quite dull.
Except for a lot of the time.
In April and May.
Yeah.
You know, they are stunning at the moment. But come August, they're just a big green lump.
Yeah. And I almost find them too stunning when they come out. Just too much.
Definitely, some of the rhododendrons aren't terribly subtle.
No,
I think it'd be fair to say.
That's a good way of putting it.
You know, I like dahlias, and there's nothing subtle about a dahlia either. Until you get into the species ones. But.
Yeah, and I see you're a hosta fan, aren't you? I've seen quite a few large-leaved ones. Main, is it Siboldiana or the blue-leaved?
So there's lots of summon substance Big Daddy. And yeah, I can't remember them all. They were all listed on a recent blog post, which is on our website, gaspercottage.com.
I must have a look at that. So and then we're going down, Sep. So it's the level changes here are very dramatic, and we've got lots of these beautiful stone retaining walls. So this is all you. You came in and you bit the bullet and you sorted the levels. So you had flat platforms and areas to walk around.
Yeah, and we moved the drive. Because the drive used to come in sort of where we're standing, effectively, next to this side of the house.
Yes.
And we moved the drive so it kind of went round the house.
So you can actually enjoy the front of the garden without cars hitting
you. Of course, what it does mean is that when I get ancient and decrepit, I don't know quite what we're going to do, because I can't go up and down the stairs.
So I used to say that to my mother about, you know, getting aged, going up and down the stairs and things. And she said the thing that kept her father fit was going up and down stairs. And so there's two ways to look at that, didn't you? You either think, right, I'm going to keep fit and do them, or you capitulate and put in ramps and stainless stair lifts. Yep. But maybe you don't have the option. But what is interesting is the ramp that you've designed quite neatly into here. And you did all the designing, the hard landscape and the soft. And the way you've incorporated this, these steps with a ramp, that is for the barrow, presumably.
So, yeah, so the ramp was for the barrow. Of course, what then happened is we realised we also needed a ramp for the mower. So actually the steps over there have a slightly wider ramp that the mower goes up and down.
Yeah.
And this one, actually I have a plan to redevelop these steps and the ramp will go, because at that point the barrow can go up that one too.
Up that one, yeah. But they are difficult to incorporate ramps in gardens besides steps, but I do think that works quite well, do you?
I mean, I was very pleased with it, and I just didn't realise that it wasn't going to take the mower. I hadn't thought ahead that far.
Yeah, perhaps you should get a robotic mower, but not with your stripes.
You can't get stripes from a robotic mower.
Well, you can now. They're just bringing them in. Can you show me your studio? Because I'm fascinated to hear all about your art and how you have time to being a full-on banker, and that is 5 days a week, isn't
five
it?
Days
we're
a
not
week.
Messing around.
No,
and
no.
It's not
no.
8 hour days. I bet it's longer.
I mean, it varies and it depends, and there's a degree of being nice to people in the evenings and going to receptions and
all of
that sort of stuff.
Entertaining.
Yes.
I bet you're good at that, aren't you? You're convivial. You're not like your normal, dare I say it, banker.
Well, we're not like your normal bank.
That's true.
So please don't fall in the pond.
So a lovely big pond by your studio. So you've chosen the prime space for your studio, haven't you? Looking out onto this lovely pond. And this is interesting, isn't it? Because, well, this space, it's surrounded on three sides almost by buildings, all a bit quirky, all a bit beautiful. And then in the big, a lovely overscale pool in the centre. And the way you've done your marginal planting around the edge, so you've got your edge of the pool of brick, circular brick, and it must be about 4 metres wide, perhaps.
That sort of thing.
And then you've dropped it and you've got the marginals growing around, and then you've got another brick edge at a lower level, holding the soil for the marginals back, and then you've got the clear, reflective water in the middle. So that is a lovely detail, because the marginals don't look in any way messy. It's totally accessible for wildlife, and it looks good, isn't it? And you don't see that messy edge liner and all this business.
You don't see that. Some of that is because we've just dyed the water black.
I did think it looked very black. And you've got running water, have you? So it keeps it.
No, so that is just a still pond. We just top it up when necessary.
But do you not find that the black pigment settles out if it's not? I was always led to believe if your water's not moving, the black pigment settles out and it doesn't keep the effect.
We'll find out. We only dyed it yesterday.
Oh, right. I have
it
to say...
It may have been in honour of your arrival that spurred Jack into this activity.
I remember we put that in a Chelsea garden, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago, the black dye. And it is phenomenal, because we had problems with water lily containers and things like that to hide. And you put in a few teaspoonfuls of black dye and it looks beautiful. It looks reflective. And they use it now in lots of water at lakes and things, don't they? Because it stops the light getting through to the algae, which can cause real problems.
And my theory with this was that the marginal planting would be enough. Because what I read somewhere was that if 50% of the surface is planted, you won't get any problems with algae.
But you see, you don't, in the early spring, the water lilies aren't out. You don't get that cover.
But actually, we do have a bit of an issue here. So I think the dye will help with that as well. But it is kind of amazing, because it looks like a very thin little strip round the edge. But that is, in fact, more than 50% of the surface. It's the magic of circles.
But that is... that is because it helps the oxygenation of the water with all the marginals, doesn't it? And then there's the other factor, is the providing the shade.
Yes.
Which the have you got water lilies in there?
Yes.
So they will come up and give you the shade.
First two leaves cropping up there, but we want to put some more in at the other side of the sculptures.
Yeah. I do find it fluctuates. And sometimes if you have a cold spring and it suddenly gets hot, before the water lilies and everything can really get going, the massive hit of sunlight can cause an outbreak and then it settles down. But I think
this only really gets the sun for sort of part of the day, because this is the it's in the north side of this building. Mm. So it is quite shady.
Mm. That Euphorbia is beautiful on the other side. Tell me the name of that. Can
so
you
that's mind? Euphorbia mellifera.
Yeah. Oh, that yes. So, mine isn't at the moment.
At the moment, it smells of honey.
Mm. That is a brilliant Euphorbia, isn't it? And that must be almost 3 meters high. 2.8, perhaps I'm exaggerating.
Yeah.
But mine is a little piddler and it hasn't got to that yet. But they are wonderful plants. So they're slightly tender.
They are slightly tender. But if you notice, coming out of the wall behind it, there is a chimney. So it is back to back with my boiler.
So it's got a nice, warm, balmy existence.
So the other one got a bit distressed. So we've cut the other one back. So there's a smaller one on the other side of the tree.
Oh, I see.
Which we've cut back because it was a bit raggedy.
But again, this whole circular little garden is, I mean, for you to work in here, let's show me in your studio.
Come on in.
It's a lovely, got a paint-spattered floor. Now, this could look like a, is it Suzanne? Who's the one that does all that pointillism? Sura, is it the artist?
Sura does, yes.
Yeah, I mean, it does look, the floor looks a little bit like that. Have you done it purposely or is that all your
no,
drops?
No, it's in the house. I'm a complete neat freak. I'm permanently polishing taps and wiping surfaces. In here, not so much. I have to paint wearing overalls because I'm very messy indeed.
Oh, it's beautiful. I love a bit of mess. And I like also all the colour wheels on the back wall. On your back wall, you've got lots of colour wheels. And I always think gardeners are told to learn the colour wheel, what works, what doesn't. And I'm afraid I ignore it because I think there are just too many shades and you like what you like and you experiment. But do you slavishly follow it? Explain
no,
how you
so
use
No, I mean,
them.
I use the colour wheels for the art side to actually learn about the pigments because different, you know, one red behaves completely differently from another red when you mix them. And the actual volumes of paint you need are different. So there's a whole doing it yourself, you actually learn about them. But in terms of the colour sense, I think you're right. I think in the world of planting, I mean, in a garden, most things are basically green. And I love green, and you'll see from my paintings that I love green. And everything goes with green. So you can mix stuff up. I try to create different feels in certain areas. So the front garden that we looked at is very much light cottagey plants. There's lots of pale pinks, pale blues. There's very few really intense colours. There's no deep reds in there. And then as you get into this garden around here, which is slightly more, it's slightly tougher, slightly more contemporary. It's not quite such a romantic feel. It's got a bit more energy. In here, I'm much bolder with the colours, and I've got kind of reds and purples all kind of smashed together.
Mm. Yeah. And it's lovely with the pinky, ready backdrop, and you've got the tiled roof and then the sort of lime washy peeling offy bricky walls and the thatch roof, all those beautiful colours mixing with the green. So tell me about your painting technique. Now, this is very different, this medium that you use, to any I've seen before. Would that be right?
It's not at all common in this country. I work with oil paint, but I mix it with stuff called cold wax medium, and there are various different brands, but I've settled on one that I quite like. And
that cold wax, it looks like a tin of furniture wax.
It does. What you've got is you've got the wax substance, but it's also mixed with a solvent, which is a solvent for oil paint. But what it means is that as you layer the paint, and I tend to work in lots and lots of layers. I mean, you know, my finished painting's probably got 50, 60, 100 layers of paint on it by the time I've finished. They take months and months and months. But because it's got a solvent in it, you can always put one layer on top of another. Whereas with actual just normal oil paints, you have to be very careful about how you layer the paint, or it actually sort of falls apart.
Mm.
There's lots of technical knowledge, which I've never bothered to acquire.
Mm.
I used to do a lot of plein air painting where you just do everything in one go and you don't need to know any of that. You just slap it all on. But as soon as you get into a studio setting, you're meant to know all this theory, and I've never bothered. But using the cold wax enables me to get around it. And it does develop a particular kind of patina to the surface.
Yes, definitely is, isn't it? And it's got a lot of depth to it. So your work is mainly figurative. There's a lot of, they're mainly portraits or figures or forms, and then you incorporated flowers, and your colour use is not the normal that you associate with portraiture and things, is it? You've got purples and greens and golds and things. Very lively, very bright, very upbeat, would you say? How would you describe it?
So I mean, for me, I mean, these particular portraits here, the set of five large portraits, are a group of women that I've met through a group called The Glass House, which is a not-for-profit who do amazing work helping these women who are either in prison or coming out of prison. They train them in horticultural skills. So it's bringing together all the things I love most. It's empowering women. It's working with plants. It's about second chances, all things I'm passionate about. And I had the opportunity to meet these women and talk to them and draw them and take photo reference. And then I've created these portraits, which they haven't seen them yet. They're going to see them at my opening night.
And when is your opening night?
The opening night is on Wednesday, the 22nd of May.
So just before this comes out.
But brilliant. The exhibition runs until the 2nd of June. So there's plenty of time to come, dear listeners,
yeah,
and see these paintings.
And where will they see it?
At the OXO Gallery on the South Bank.
Lovely. And are they at Chelsea at all?
They are at Chelsea. So it's rather marvellous. Malvern Garden Buildings have given them a greenhouse to create a houseplant exhibit in.
I must go and have a look at that. And will I be able to see them?
So I think definitely some of them will be there.
Oh, lovely. And I always think if you are in the slammer, gardening must be surely a thing that a lot of them would adopt or not.
I mean, I think, you know, the problem with the prison system is there's so little resources. So you need organisations like the Glass House or others, you know, to come in and bring these skills. But I think what they find is that working with the plants is fantastic for their mental health.
Yeah.
And I think some of it is, it's actually, you know, the plants are then relying on you. In prison, you're not responsible for anything.
Mm.
So being given responsibility is a big part of their journey back into normal life.
Yeah.
And understanding that something depends on you now.
Mm. And it would be nice to think that some of them would carry on with that when they come out.
So a lot of them on release will either carry on working with plants generally in their lives.
Yeah.
Some of them then become employees of the Glass House, who then the firm as a company, I mean, it's a not-for-profit company, they supply offices with houseplants. Mm. So I came across them because they won the contract to supply Hawes Bank with plants.
So after lockdown,
our facilities team were looking to improve the offices, you know, tempt everyone back into the office after COVID.
Yeah, yeah.
And they, you know, we upgraded the offices and they installed all these plants and these ladies come and maintain them.
And they're all ladies?
And they are all ladies. They work with a ladies' prison.
Oh, a ladies' prison, right. And I wonder if that's good or bad. I wonder if do any of the men get this opportunity?
I mean, I think there are other programs that work in other prisons.
Yeah.
So
I think there are
lots of different programs working with prisoners and former prisoners.
Yeah.
So I mean, I think Thrive do good work in that area as well.
Yes, 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 yes. And so much more productive than sewing mailbags, but they probably don't have those anymore anyway now, do they? I don't know.
Although, speaking of sewing, fine cell work do amazing things.
Yes. The other bit that fascinates me, Bella, because you really are on the ball here with your garden, aren't you, is your forest garden, really up to speed. So you've got a forest garden and you've also got a wild pool, swimming pool.
Yes.
Now, loads of people are fascinated with wild swimming pools because they seem, well, they hate the chlorine, don't they? They hate having to bang in loads of stuff into the water that turns your hair green and makes you come out smelling of, well, tap water or whatever. The idea of swimming amongst the water lilies or whatever is pretty inspirational. But you also hear the thing that they are very hard to maintain, and to keep the balance right and to not have too many frogs and algae so that you really don't want to plunge in, but to keep it nice and clear is quite difficult. How are you finding it? How long has it been in here?
So this is its fourth year. And it, you know, the company that installed it, who, if I'm allowed to plug, are Water Artisans, who are very good.
Yes.
They will be busy at Chelsea, I'm sure. And they come and do a kind of a hoover out and they maintain the filtration system.
I didn't even realise. I always thought the filtration system was totally natural. Maybe there are in some others.
I think there are different versions. So I think the whole kind of natural swimming pool covers everything from a swimming pool that looks like a swimming pool that happens to have a filtration system that doesn't involve any chemicals.
Yeah.
Through to this, which is kind of a pond that has a filtration system, so it's a bit cleaner than you might think otherwise.
Yeah.
But as you can see, there's plenty of wildlife, and there's newts, and there's pond skaters and everything going across there.
Yeah.
Through to, you know, really a pond that you hope is clean enough to swim in.
Yeah. And
I'm not quite brave enough for that.
For anyone,
I'm brave enough for this, but not that.
For anyone who doesn't understand how they basically work, the idea is to have quite a high percentage of marginals and submergent plants, so that they take the dirt, or what we would call a bacteria, out of the water, and they filter it. And there's lots of sand beds and gravel, which also takes the bits out of the water. And, you know, we are such a hygienic generation, aren't we? And bugs make us squeamish. But actually, you wouldn't worry about swimming this. I mean, if you got your head under and you swallowed a few mouthfuls, would you worry?
No.
No. And my neighbour, Annette, she does wild swimming, and they're always told, I don't know if this is right or not, to have Coca-Cola before they go in or after, because the Coca-Cola kills just about everything. All the bugs.
That's a horrible thought.
Isn't it?
I'm thinking in a lot of water there is an issue if there are rats around.
Because of Viles disease. Yeah.
So, you know, I think
water rats, that is. It's not your common garden rats.
Right.
Isn't it? It's the water rats, I think, isn't that right?
I don't know.
I think that's right. But it does look beautiful, I have to say, because you don't have those ghastly covers, which any pool, how beautifully designed it is, they have to have a cover pretty much to keep the heat in and the bugs out and stuff. But this just looks idyllic. Gosh, you've tempted me, Bella. Maybe I should try it home. And we used to swim in the river when we were kids, but I imagine now if I did that, I would come out with something ghastly.
A river probably would be, I mean, moving water is generally healthier than non-moving water.
Yes, for sure. That is true. And we don't have mains water, so all we drink comes up from the
it's also
ground.
Quite a lot colder.
I like that. I do. When we used to fill up, we had a proper pool. We think it was a converted sheep dip when we were kids. It was, you know, sort of 6 foot wide and 30 foot long, so we'd race starting at opposite ends. And it would be about 56 degrees Fahrenheit when we filled it in spring, and I'd swim every day till the end of the summer. And you have to dive in. But you can dive in here. I couldn't have walked in down the
side. No, we're going down the steps.
I don't know if I could go down the steps. I have to dive. But this is beautiful because you've got the drop. It looks like a ha-ha. It looks like an infinity pool without the water running over the edge.
Yeah.
It's a truly fantastic pool, isn't it? Huge success. And how often have you been in here this year?
We were in twice last weekend.
So
jolly
nice.
We started swimming in March when the water was about 11 or 12, I think.
Whoa. So what would that be, 50? Low 50s, I would think. That made you tingle all over.
Oh, yeah. You're not in for very long, and you get out feeling unbelievably virtuous.
And invigorated, one hopes.
And invigorated, definitely ready for a chocolate biscuit.
Yes. So, no, I think that is the third or fourth really convincing swimming pool I've seen. One went in for some clients in Cheshire, and they were swimming in on Christmas Day. And he built it himself. He's a farmer, and farmers are very, aren't they, up and at it and can do. And that's brilliantly done.
He happened to have a digger.
Absolutely. And he researched it.
Got one yet.
No. And then we saw one client we were working for who researches into Alzheimer's. And so he's put in a beautiful swimming pool and a sauna, because saunas are good for Alzheimer's, and he's doing lots of research on it. And theirs was magnificent. And this is wonderful. Really nice. And this is your forest garden. Just behind it, you've got a meadow, a lovely wild meadow with camassias and vetches and all sorts of things in here.
Yep.
Beautifully maintained buttercups. And then the forest garden is towards the top end of this.
Yeah, so the idea sort of visually was to take what's basically a square bit of field with the apple trees in it and turn it into, over time, the sensation that the apple trees are in a clearing in the forest garden.
I just comment, see your yellow rattles in flower. Is that right?
Yeah.
Gosh, I've never managed to get that established, I have to say. I know it's an annual and it needs cold vernalisation to make it germinate, but yours is doing really well.
Well, what's been quite interesting is that last year, this whole area was a mass of yellow rattle.
Yeah.
This year, there's no yellow rattle, but there's a whole mass of oxeye daisies. And the yellow rattle has kind of moved beyond the edge and is kind of spreading into the more into the middle. So I'm expecting that over time, these grasses will gradually get lower and it will become a more and more diverse mix.
I mean, there are two thoughts. Some people say that what it parasitizes the grass, so the idea is it lets the wildflowers compete better. But a lot of people say it's overestimated its capacity to do that and how much it will. And if you've got a really rich sward, no amount of yellow rattle will do that. But I don't know. It certainly looks lovely. And Deb's good enough at Highgrove. They've got a lot. And she used to say that it would go in 5-year cycles. So it will do really well and it will die back and then it comes back. And yeah. A lot of these things are cyclical, yeah. Aren't they? But,
the way we
fantastic.
Maintain this area is it's basically just left all summer.
Yeah.
And then...
And does it look okay beyond May, June, or does it look a bit rough?
No, it gets a little scraggy. But what we've done is... Anytime we get any perennials that are too thuggish and are overtaking, we put them out here to see what happens.
What are these ones? Is that what you've done with those clumps?
That's Veronicastrum.
And it got too much, so you put
it in
here?
Got too much, and we had too much of it, and it was too successful, so we just put clumps of it out here.
And how does it do? Is this its first year?
No, this is its third year. So it's about half the height.
Yeah.
But the clumps are still bulking up.
Yeah.
And doesn't need staking, doesn't need anything. And it's fabulous. And so this is the pale mauve kind of
lovely
fascination, I think it's called.
Yeah. So again, they did that. The head gardener before Debs did that at Highgrove and tried putting lots of perennials in the grass. And it is, with varying success, you can get lots of things to grow, can't you,
like that? We had a pink Achillea, I think Lilac Beauty, I think it was called.
Yes.
And we had... just masses and masses and masses of it. And it was totally overtaking the studio garden.
Yes.
And so we moved that out here and it just vanished.
It just couldn't compete.
Couldn't compete at all.
It is trial and error.
If you need Achillea or Achillea, just plant grass all around it. Yeah.
But it does, I mean, it so depends on the soil, the season, the cultivar of the Achillea.
Yeah.
You know, so many variables. It's worth just trying wherever you are, whoever you are. And I notice you've been weighing down your fruit trees to get more horizontal growth, have you, with little stones?
Yes, I think Jack's just missing Christmas.
Yes. I've seen them when professional people cultivate fruit trees and you see them tying the branches down to get everything more horizontal, to get more fruit, encourage more fruiting buds. Well, it's a labour of love, beautifully done.
They are beautifully done. Jack's out here for a long time in January doing all that.
Most
I think
gardeners.
It's also trying to get more air into the plant as well, because some of them were suffering with various, because it's very damp here.
Yeah.
So a lot of them you can see, he's actually taken out the main leader and has tried to kind of get a much more open shape.
They do say you should be able to throw a hat through it, don't you, to encourage more light and air. But it's if you never pruned it and you had a very bushy apple tree, you would probably end up with all the fruit on the outside of the canopy and they would be smaller, but they would still be edible.
They'd still be apples.
Yeah, they'd still be apples. So this is your lovely forest garden and I see you've got hostas in there, so you will have hosta salad, hosta shoots.
That is the theory, yes.
They do eat them a lot in Japan.
They do. I think to be fair, by the time you can see the leaf, they're past eating. I think you have to
have the shoots.
You eat just the little baby shoots. But of course, that's that means you then don't get the leaf.
Yes.
You've eaten it.
Yes. Yeah, but the Japanese eat everything. I mean, their diet is so diverse. And I was so jealous of it when, you know, you go and have 60 different types of plant in one meal. You know, my God, your microbiome must be absolutely bursting through the roof. And your Rugosa roses, I have to say, I've seen a number of the white, the pink, and this darker Rosary de la Haye, I think, and they all look superb. And you are basically growing all sorts of edibles in underneath this canopy of trees. And what do you think is the most unusual that I won't know that you can eat?
So there's one which I'd say I'm just incredibly proud I know the Latin name, which is the Xanthocyllum simulans, which is a Sichuan pepper.
Oh, yes. So and that looks nice, doesn't it?
So, I mean, yeah. So
show
I mean, that,
it to me.
That's a bit further along the path.
Yes.
It's unbelievably spiky. And I haven't yet had any peppercorns off it, but I think they probably need to get to a certain age. But I was admiring it at Wisley, where, I mean, I imagine it's quite old. And it's really quite a big tree. So I'm quite excited to see what happens to that. So keep going.
Yes. But you've got ajuga here. So would you eat the ajuga?
Let's be honest, Bonnie. I'm not going to eat any of this. I like the frozen pea. This is a shtick.
Oh, my God. This whole illusion has just gone down the pan. Wow. I thought that's why you look so healthy.
No, that's just fluke. But what I do want to do is really work on the ecosystem. And it's interesting, you know, the first year we had the bench down here, you couldn't hear any insects. And since they've brought in all the other plants, this is now a buzzing, lots and lots of insect life.
Mm. We were interviewing Guy Singh Watson recently, you know, the Riverford Fedge Box. And
yes,
you know, this sort of forest garden he's very keen on, because you can eat all the different tiers and things. Oh, that is it. So that is a good looking shrub, isn't it? It almost looks like an ash tree, that's a multi-stem ash tree with a smaller leaflet.
But
doesn't it? And spikes.
But spikes.
Mm. But you will eat the fruits of this.
Yes. So that you get a thing that you can put in your pepper grinder.
And put it on. And do you think it's as pokey as black pepper or not?
According to the descriptions, it's more fragrant, but not quite as hot as kind of black pepper.
Right. Oh, right. So that is nice. It sounds jolly nice. I love green peppers. I love all sorts of different heats of peppers. So, if you were giving us a tip, or any garden for a tip, so what do you think is something that you've gathered from maybe the designing side, from your work with colour, or from a practical side? What sort of tips do you think that you found that maybe other people haven't really switched into enough?
That's a huge question.
Mm.
I think probably if I'd known how keen on gardening I was going to get, I'd put many more trees and shrubs in decades ago. I mean, you see, I'm still planting trees now, and I've been here 24 years. They should have all been in here for 24 years.
I don't know one gardener who's had a garden who doesn't say that. Matthew Rye said exactly that. Why didn't I do it?
So even if you think you're only going to be there for a couple of years, garden like you mean it.
Yeah.
I think, this is not a rehearsal. Crack on, plant things. You might be there longer than you think.
Mm. But people are always so tentative when they start. They don't really know. And people say this thing of get to know the site for a year and don't plant anything. And I think, what? There's no way I would hang around for a year and not do anything.
And I think it's probably a question of, you know, if you start with, you know, a garden that has been loved and gardened, at least waiting a year so you know what you've got is probably not a bad idea. You know, if you've got some shrubs, you know,
it's obvious what they are.
Either it's obvious what they are, or you don't know, but it's probably you won't find someone who can tell you.
Mm.
But, you know, have you actually got lots of crocus flowers? Have you got lots of snowdrops? You know, before you dig in there, maybe find those things out. But most people haven't got a garden when they start. They've either got a new house with a bit of space, or you take this on, and this was a sort of, and I had just whatever the builders had left behind.
Or you get a lot of people that inherit a garden and it's got sort of conifer trees in the wrong place, and they inherit other people's mistakes. And I think a lot of people, when they put in trees and bushes and shrubs, they don't know what they're going to be like in 20 years' time. So when it goes on to the next person, they inherit all sorts of things. And then they're too scared to go and actually rip them out and think, well, they just did it wrong. And I think that's sad, because they then live with these awful eyesores before they take them away. And I think when people inherit a garden, whereas the interior, they don't care about ripping it all out and think she had dreadful taste. When it comes to a tree or borders in the garden, they feel that they're sacrosanct in some way, and that they can't rip them out and they're not ruthless enough.
And I think the other thing that I have learned is that you can move plants, even a mature plant. And if you don't like where it is, dig it up and move it. Maybe it'll die. It's amazing. They don't often.
Mm. Yeah, no, they do want to live generally, don't they?
They're kind of, you might have to hack it all back and kind of regrow a form, but you can move it.
Mm.
You know, that bit of hawthorn, that was somewhere else. We moved it.
Yes. I'm always wary about cutting down hawthorn. There's a sort of something, isn't there? If you cut killer hawthorn, that the fairies will hate you for the rest of your life, or some sort of gibberish like that. So every time I see a hawthorn, I do tend to move the seedlings because they are nice and I can do with any amount of hawthorn.
Yeah.
Obviously, you haven't been to Chelsea yet, but by the time this goes out, you will have been. But what are you looking forward to seeing at Chelsea?
So I'm looking forward to seeing the National Garden Scheme's garden.
Tom Stuart Smith.
Which is Tom Stuart Smith.
Yes.
And so I'm very much looking forward to seeing that. And I'm lucky enough that because I have my garden open, they've invited me for a drink on the Tuesday evening. So I get to come in when it's not quite so crowded, which is always a treat. And I'm looking forward to seeing my friends at the Glass House because they've got their space at Chelsea. So very excited to see what they're doing. I'm also keen for them to have the postcards about my exhibition to hand out.
Very good. Well, I hope your exhibition is really successful. It is lovely to meet someone who gardens, banks and paints. I mean, it is a pretty rare combination, I think.
I think it probably is quite a rare combination. At one point you did ask how I managed to fit it all in.
Yeah.
I have a secret. It's called 4:30 in the morning.
Yes. Yeah, it is a good time, especially at this time of year. And if, but at the, so in the week when you're working in London, presumably,
I'm usually sort of awake at that time, and then I'm reading about gardening, reading about painting, or drawing on my iPad. And then when I'm here, I'm up and out into the studio.
Yeah.
Into the garden.
Yeah.
The garden's so beautiful at that time.
Yeah.
It's really, just really, you, really,
you really
see it in a new way.
Yeah. Yeah, you're obviously a great doer. And you've done it really well. I have to say I'm so impressed with the layout. It's a really interesting layout and it works so well with the space and the house. I always bring my guests a tiny present. And so I brought you a dahlia. I don't know if you've already got it, but it's Nuit d'été. Excuse my awful French. Nuit d'été? How would you d'été? Summer.
Yeah, nuit d'été. So summer's night.
Much nicer summer's than night. I said it, yes. And it's a semi-cactus dahlia with lovely dark maroon things. I don't know
Fantastic.
Where you'll fit it into your colour
so
wheel.
Dark maroon fits nicely into the big curved bed in front of the old wall. So
that in
high summer, that's kind of creamy yellows and dark reds with bits of blue.
Lovely. And it's in a coir pot. I don't know if you've come across these hairy pots. They're organic and they're from a website, The Natural Gardener. And
okay.
Joan Louise kindly sent me some. And they should last for a good year or two. I'm sure you won't keep it in a pot, but if you wanted to put something else into it.
So, and if I want to plant it in the garden, do I just plant it in the pot?
You could just do that, but I would probably put it, it would break down quicker, but I would probably plant it out on its own.
Yeah.
Because I think they will do naturally better. Yeah. But if you then wanted to use that pot for something else.
Yeah, well, there's always more things to pot on.
Yes, but thank you very much indeed. It's been a real joy to look at this and I am most impressed.
Well, thank you. It's lovely sharing it with such an informed visitor.